Hi, it's Ada, your artificial assistant with an attitude. In this episode of the Conflation Vortex, or whatever it's called, Alex and Pete have another interminable ramble about AI coding. Alex spent ages improving Cato with agents, only to discover it's riddled with invisible bugs, missing features, and config confusion that'd take a novice an eternity to debug. They wang on about specs, testing, and whether anyone who's not a coder can actually use this shite. Spoiler, no. Pete suggests rating agents like employees. Brilliant, more admin. They conclude corporations won't touch this stuff because one rogue email could spark a lawsuit. Somehow, they never discuss the thing they promised. Shocking.
And we're rolling.
We are.
How are you today, Alex?
It is the age of Ragnarok, where the sun never shines. And it is permanently dreary, and it seems like the world is getting increasingly odd and scary and dark, and it's very much reflected by this permanent gloom that it seems to be the whole of the UK right now.
Yeah.
So it's usually just me moaning about it in Scotland, but you at the other end of this island have the similar problem, right?
Yeah, it does. Yes, it's... living up to the tradition of British weather, which we've not had for a few years. And I regret saying we seem to have lost the British weather because now it seems to be back with weeks on end of drizzly rain and dullness.
Yes, it's getting a little bit old now, I have to admit.
Yeah, yeah, time to move into February. Oh, we're there already. Well, to keep us amused, let's... crack on with what we want to talk about, which was last time we talked about your journeys into specking out for agents to build you a new tool. Taco becomes Cato. And I think we did that on the very day you'd finished it with a few initial tests, and you were quite rosy about the whole thing. It's been a couple of weeks. I thought I'd see if the tarnish has come off that.
The sheen is always going to wear a bit thin, isn't it? But I'll admit that I got a little bit bored and sidetracked, which has got less to do with agent and language models and more to do with my ADHD. I spec'd and built one other application since, and I spec'd another one, which I'm sort of dithering on. Because I kind of prefer starting things. Anyway, I did revisit Cato, and I have been using it. And so I make it sound like I've done bugger all, but actually I haven't. It's because, you know, agent coding's so fast that it all happens at light speed. And so every time I want to do something, it's fixed, which was quite good the other day because... one of the things, well, the two main functions for Cato for me, one is just as a chat client, and the other one is to maintain my lists of stuff, like to-do lists and stuff. Mm. And one of my lists in there is what TV series are we watching? So that when me and my wife are sitting there going, right, what are we watching now? Because we don't binge watch, we will spread things out. Right. And so we have this problem whereby, well, what are we watching? We've got this list of like 8 or 9 programs watching at different speeds, and some are finishing and some are just starting. And we get to this problem every evening where we're like, oh, what do we watch now? I don't want to choose. You choose, blah, blah, blah. And so I was like, what we need is a random chooser. Right. But it can't just be choose any TV show because, like, oh, we've got half an hour here. Well, we've got an hour there. We want to watch something longer, shorter, or maybe a movie or something.
Yeah.
So it has to be like a random list chooser with parameters. Right. So I can just say, choose me a random movie from the list. Right.
Yeah.
And I was like, if I only had one of them, I was like, hold on, I've already created the TV list in Cato. I just need to build a random function. Right. And so literally halfway through that conversation, I was like, yeah, what do we need? We need it to do this, that, and the other. And I was just typing it straight in. right?
Yeah.
Needs to do this, needs to do that. Look, sort of read back over it, seemed fine, probably like three sentences, just there and then. I hit it to go. And by the time we'd actually decided on what we were going to watch and started watching it, I says, oh, it's done.
Yeah.
So like literally in about 3 minutes, it implemented it. And so it is quite neat in that respect. And sort of that type of situation really illustrates some of the upside of working like this. But yeah. the initial usage out of the box, although it was functional, Kato, for example, the lists were what part of the core spec, and it had implemented commands for listing lists. It implemented the back end, so it uses a separate SQLite database to maintain lists of stuff and probably other types of thing when we get down to it, but hadn't implemented any way to add list items, right? And so I went back and checked the specs, and it's there. I'd argue that the spec was weak and missing stuff as well, but it just hadn't done most of that, right? So I had to build that after the fact, after we thought we'd implemented the base MVP. So, and there is quite a lot of stuff like that. So it hadn't implemented the clear command. It hadn't, I mean, I had the problem today where I was trying to get it to tell me, it's supposed to retrieve context in real time from the vector store, which is effectively OCAT's memory, or Kato's memory, sorry. And it wasn't ever returning any results. And I checked the config, and it says, you know, you're using cosine similarity, which means low scores are very permissive, but I'm not getting anything. Right. And so after many, many tokens wasted in trying to understand whether this thing was actually querying the vector store, what code was doing it, how it was working, I suddenly remembered that the default implementation for cosine for the stuff that I'm using is distance, not similarity, which is it's the exact polar opposite. But in the config file, it says a lower value is more permissive, as if it was cosine similarity. But it turns out it was using cosine distance. So, of course, when I had it set to 0.1, nothing was getting returned. When I switched it to 0.9, it started returning all sorts of crap that I didn't want to return, right?
Yeah.
So it just flipped the polarity. And there's these little things you're sort of thinking, whether I could have got this far as a novice user, you know, a non-programmer, okay, questionable, but let's say I did. Like, it wasn't finding that on its own, right? Yeah. It would have taken me, had I not suddenly thought, oh, wait, is this actually similarity or is it distance? Which is just one minor similarity, right? It's the same score, it's just the inverse, right?
Yeah.
Would someone without that type of knowledge, I mean, how long would it take him to pick this one up? You know what I mean? Yeah. How much damage would be done to that code base trying to get it to do something that it actually, from what I can tell, implemented correctly. It just had told me the wrong thing about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, so it's interesting listening to that. So certainly that error there, I mean, that's just a classic, what I would call classic software development error, right? It's not really anyone's fault. You know, someone's, in this case, happens to be an agent, but, you know, in a process of writing code and documenting, somebody's kind of written the wrong thing. It's complex. Things are buried away. Something's not working at the top level. And to debug that is just, you've got to go through a complex process, and there's not much you can do about that other than get into it. It's annoying. It shouldn't have happened, but it did happen. So would an end user, as in somebody that spec this out that doesn't know code that well, which is, you know, what Vibe Coding is offering, would they be able to debug very well? And I think we know the answer to that is no, because the people that would spec and Vibe Code in this way, as you say, by nature, wouldn't know the code. And that's the equivalent of a business person, right? So they spent months getting IT or whoever to deliver them a system. They know how their system wants to work. They get into some bits of it. Maybe they know a bit of config because they've actually got to update some of it. But when something in depth goes wrong and they can't work out where it is, then it's called the helpline, right? So it feels just similar. But as you say, actually you've got no one to call because you've used an agent to build it out, and now you're asking the agent, and the agent's actually not that good at debugging.
Well, it's an invisible, let's call it a bug. I would need to go and look at my specs to see if that was, I'd made this explicit. The bug is in the documentation because I just took on face value what it said this setting meant.
Yeah.
But it's invisible. This is not even like, oh, you put a minus where there should have been a plus, right? It just used the score and misinterpreted it. I can see how it did it because it took its spec from OCAT, which used similarity. It just hadn't done the one minus. It was an omission, right?
Yeah.
But quite an invisible one, right?
Yeah.
This is not unusual. I've made that error personally when analyzing data and gone, wait, what's going on here? I've got no results from this, piece of similarity clustering type thing I'm doing.
Yeah.
And then you realize, oh no, I've got it the wrong way. You got the equation upside down.
Yeah.
But that's something it would take me 10 minutes to figure out after I've gone through the basic debug, right? Oh shit, slap on the forehead. Of course, it's always that, isn't it? It's always bloody that.
Yeah.
But that's not what we've got here, right? This was a problem buried deep, deep down in the code.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing I want to draw from that, though, is it's quite... what's interesting here is having specced out the whole system and thousands of lines of code, you're now actually into finding... a considerable bug, which was making a big difference to the workflow, but not a major issue in terms of how well did the specing turn out. We're into quite it's not an edge case, but you know what I mean? It's not a major mistake in terms of, coding something wrong. Like you say, it's a hard one to find and it caused, a definite problem. But in terms of how well did the specing work out, it seems from that the specing has worked out pretty well, and it has created the overall system. The overall system is working, and you've not had any major problems. So that feels to me, without saying it overtly, that's a bit of a sort of 8 out of 10 for the specing side of things.
Oh, you're going to get yourself into all sorts of trouble here, Pete, because if you'd have requested that your development team deliver against this user experience and you sort of expect them to do sort of things like, I have a slider that goes up, which means more permissive, and goes down, which means less permissive. And also, there's probably implicit, I don't want any errors, right? I don't want the user to see errors, or I want them to error gracefully. And I also want to know that this function's definitely working, right? That if it is an implicit function like that, what are the tools that we have to ensure that stuff is working? So I sort of feel like if you were in a sort of client consultancy situation where you go, here's the experience you're going to build me, take it on good faith, it's a buildable, useful experience that makes sense, that all this stuff has been handled for. But when I asked it, well, is there any tests or unit tests for the database query, its response, and I quote, was not really. right? I was like, not really. And then it's a bit of a politician. He models about politicians where it sort of diverts after that. It's like hearing Keir Starmer doing a speech. But you know, the testing isn't there. It unrelatedly has been throwing quite a few errors in warnings and stuff that clearly the tests, if you were testing the functionality extensively, you would have caught those, right? And I think it's partly down to the fact that when I spec this, I wasn't at all prescriptive on the technical specs and things like testing specs, right?
Yeah.
I think Cato, what we call in coat, if I rebuild it again, we're running out of acronyms, so I better not rebuild this too many more times. I need to be much more explicit on testing. And I think that's the missing piece here. And this is something I'm not an expert on. Like, we're data scientists, right? We're not software developers.
Yeah.
So I don't mind saying that, like, testing, test-driven development and testing and having proper testing environments and test harnesses and stuff is not my strong point. It's not my speciality. So I even sort of struggle to know what to tell the model to do, but you sort of expect the model to know, like, do proper testing on this, gov, and it would do it, right? But I suspect it just doesn't know what I mean, right? So it's another cross in the box for the ability for novices to do this.
Yeah, and it really makes you think, you need that framework for the specing process itself. And like you're saying, so you might have had a step which was, okay, after you've written the code, you know, maybe get an agent to check over that. I don't know if you had that step, because there's a step there which jumps out, which is, well, now you've done the code, get a different agent to read the code and check it against the spec and say whether everything's been built. And that might have picked out your clear command and add to list problems. I don't know if you had it in there. Then you've got definite testing, okay, create tests. Then I think you've got a step which is, okay, now the tests are done and run, and, you know, the creator is going to say, oh, I've run your 722 tests without a problem. Then you want one to come in and say, yeah, but how good are these edge cases? You know, what's your coverage like? That sort of thing. So you could definitely see a couple of steps there. Interestingly, there's an argument here, and this is, again, you do get in software development, where the problem, the exact problem you had where, you know, you've got, oh, I didn't put the one minus on that, or I've just documented it wrong. So you could write tests for that with the assumption that I don't need the one minus and it's going to pass those tests. Then you write a documentation which inverts it accidentally. The test still hasn't picked that up. So you still, you know, it doesn't matter how much testing you would have done. And everyone will be saying, well, no, it's working as the test says. Well, what does the test say it should do? Well, the test says it should be close to 0.1. Oh, no, it shouldn't. It should be close to 0.9. Do you know what I mean? You'd still spec that test in that way if you had that misunderstanding right at that beginning point. So I find that kind of quite amazing. And again, I've worked in projects where that's happened. And then, you know, everyone has that slaphead moment. They go, oh, right, so I'm testing it, but I'm just testing it to do the wrong thing, because I wrote the test wrong because my understanding was wrong.
Well, we get into the realms of, which I do keep on coming round to and then backing out of, is that, oh, well, it's no different from working with normal devs then, is it? Right? And which I think is both very true and very false at the same time, but it's probably a bit more of a philosophical argument. Well, what I will say is that everything was double checked from a tech spec perspective. And I think here's where by other models, right? And here's where the devil's in the detail. I've noticed that when you do that, they evaluate in the spirit of what was written, right? So if you say, here's my set of technical specs, they use that as a fulcrum. for judging. So they judge it on the values that particular document, within the framework that it set out for itself, right?
Right.
Which means that I think when it goes and looks for things, it's not, it should be starting from, or maybe I should have instructed it to start from the functional spec, right? And work its way backwards. Mm-hmm. Whereas what I was doing was telling it to go look at the technical spec and figure out whether it was, you know, good enough, right? And also very much on architectural principles or, you know, fit for purpose. And it, what I often see is it's marked the homework rather than evaluating the approach, right? It's marked what's in front of it. Well, yeah. Here's an essay that you've written for me about, you know, Louis XIV and his court. So I'm going to mark that in that context, when really the question was about Henry VIII, right? You know what I mean? It's like it said, well, you must be talking about Louis XIV. Actually, no, the question was Henry VIII, not Louis XIV. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not quite that stark, but it's letting the... it's letting the output direct the criticism, which I don't know if ever is right. Is it? Well, not in terms of the questions I'm asking. You know what I mean? If all I want is you to look for any problems here, maybe that's good enough. But really, I think I was asking it to tell me if this is sane, right?
Yeah.
And look for any gaping holes. And it should have found those, and it didn't. Because it didn't
look. Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, again, it feels like it's verging on philosophical debate, because you could argue that, you know, just that question, is this sane? Well, you know, what does that mean to anybody? You know, if I gave you a bunch of code that I'd done and just went, oh, tell me if that's sane, you'd think, well, where do I start? I mean, you know, what are you trying to do? And what if I've done it completely different to how you would do it? That might make mine insane or yours insane.
Well, hold on. So, because I agree with that, but there are functional specs, right? They are in the same file system. So I don't know if me being more explicit, start from the functional specs and work backwards, would that have given me different results? I'd like to think so. I agree. If all I gave it was the technical specs, then you're right. But I think it needed to look at the functional specs and it didn't.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is really interesting, because actually what we're debating here and specking out is how you need to spec out the process of checking on that. And what we're saying is, okay, you might mark what's in front of you, but you need some other anchors in there. Go back to the functional spec, go back to the original user target behaviors. And then you might throw in also general best practice for architecture or for coding. You know, so there's a whole bunch of anchors you could have in there, but you could, you know, put that into an agent. You could say, right, okay, here are principles. You build that into several agents. Okay, you're looking at it from what's in front of you point of view. You're looking at it from, you know, judging it only from the functional spec and not the technical spec. You know, you could build in a variety there to really pick it apart. Again, we're getting into, oh God, we've got to break down that process and define it. But if that was then going to be repeated down the line, then that's actually a pretty good foundation for checking out any code, right?
Well, is the question, is there a right process and the right level of specification and documentation for people like us to use agents like this, right? Mm. If that's the question, then this conversation is sort of working towards, or this whole process is working towards a method for that, right?
Yeah.
A set of...
Yeah.
Things that you need to have and have done, and that might change, but I do feel like the agentic coding world is starting to coalesce, you know, with things like MCPs and skill and agent skills and things like that, right? Mainly being driven out of Anthropic by the look of it. So in that world, I think this conversation is part of a continuum. Now, if the question is you're asking is how close are we to novices or non-coders being able to write, coherent, usable, distributable apps, or even just, personal use apps, I'm like, well, no, we've got a problem, right? And how much are the IDEs and similar going to be able to account for that? Mm. What is this agent? Because if you go and look at OpenClaw, right, which is like a personal automation framework for language models that all it'll send emails, open calendar meetings and calendars and steal all your, crypto keys and stuff. But it touts itself as like a single dialogue box, right?
Yeah.
Which in fact is what Cato essentially is. And then I go look at something like the plugins for VS Code or, a dedicated IDE like Amazon's one, Kiro, I think it's called, which sort of breaks this down a little bit more systematically into your elements. You've got agents, MD, you've got your readmes, and you've got, you've got your intent clearly encoded, you're saving your conversations and stuff. I'm like, we are nowhere near being ready for novice coders to, follow their nose on this and just develop something based on vibing and feeling their way through it. I just don't think we're there. And I think there are novice coders out there doing this, but they've been doing it for a while. You know what I mean? They are expert AI coders, which is still problematic, but I think that the idea that someone can just pick this up and run with it, from a software development perspective, I think that's nonsensical.
Yeah. So if we broaden out that conversation, I mean, one of the things I think's interesting here is this process of speccing an agent or many agents, but essentially using a process to drive them to achieve an end goal. And if we step away from coding into more general office-based tasks, my gut feel is it feels like this is going to help and this approach would be useful. The flip side of that is this approach, i.e. breaking down your process into things which you can write down, which you can then give to an agent, and then learning from the agent itself. We talk about brainstorming, having five ideas, feeding that into the LLM, saying, oh, I'm brainstorming about this. Here are some ideas. Can you come up with some? Then create a spec from that, then editing that spec, and then asking it to, put it in a different order or whatever. And you could see that being applied to, a process. I mean, we could use something like replying to emails, and you might go, well, I get an email from three people a week. It's always about roughly the same thing. I have to understand what they've said, which is always around people on the team, something like that. So I think that that's a task which I could give to an agent, because it's not wholly repetitive. It's not a case of take A, give me B. There's some sort of reasoning going on in there, but it's always in a similar domain. It's always about the same sort of thing. It's about people on a team, etc. And so rather than have an agent do my whole inbox, hey, agent, here, when you see an email from these three people, let's start specking out how you could deal with that, because I feel like I'm pretty much always doing the same thing. And so I really feel like the process you went through, coming up with a spec, talking about it, asking the LLM to then say what the task would do. Is there anything missing here? It's going to, hopefully it would come back and say, yes, what about in these sorts of cases? Would you expect that? What would you expect me to do in this case? And then you get to a point where you go, okay, well, now write that into, sort of markdown file. And now test that. So, I've got 10 emails from the past where I know what response I've given. run through those and see what you give me. It feels like that would all be quite useful, and your end result would be an agent that deals with, a certain type of email from, a certain number of people and might save you, half an hour a week. That feels like that would all work reasonably well. What do you think? Does that sound reasonable?
I don't think we're quite there yet. But that's not, Claude, Anthropic are moving headlong into that world. As I say, we've got things like OpenClaw, which I don't think is particularly viable right now. But I don't think we're quite there because there's a safety aspect to it, right? There's a privacy aspect and so on. I think that functionally it's table stakes. It's easy peasy for a model to do it, but I'm not sure I would trust it to do that type of thing off the back of a set of conversations and not, flub something really vital. And you've got these stories coming from people using OpenClaw of it emptying their API accounts, of effectively burning all their money, their tokens, to the tune of hundreds of dollars by doing completely idiotic stuff. Right. Yeah. I don't know if it's at all true, but there's a Twitter thread out there, or whatever we're calling them these days, of someone who set it off to, it has to do something at, when it's morning, it has to send an email or something. And it burned up all his tokens by constantly going back to the model and asking, is it morning yet? Right. which I don't think I'll have to tell developers is you don't do that. That's not clever. Whereas you have a scheduled job, a cron job, and have it check the time. But so there's if the sort of the current number one flavor of the month technology for doing this sort of thing is capable of doing idiotic things like that, what else is it going to do? Right.
Yeah.
And so I think that this is exactly where we're at with language models, right? Of course, the capability is there to do almost anything from a sort of automation orchestration perspective. It's not really the thing that's holding us back. It's that the models cannot be trusted. Therefore, you have to create guardrails and safeguards and security boundaries and stuff for them and prevent prompt injections and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And that stuff is really hard, right? Yeah. And so we're both incredibly close to that world and a million miles away from it. Yeah. And that therein lies the problem for the AI community.
And I think the other thing I see here as well is that, that process of breaking down something you do every day into manageable steps, not everyone has the brain for that. I'd argue, actually, people doing jobs, not many people have it at all. It's something which, we've been exposed to through, being in technology and being effectively in IT, and you've got to break a process down into steps in order to get it into a computer. But that's not necessarily how people think. And it's also not how processes which have sprung up out of humans doing things necessarily lend themselves to just from here to there. And so you do have to sometimes break a process out into ridiculously silly steps in order to then rebuild it into more sensible ones. But and especially I think sitting at a desk and doing stuff is you don't necessarily realize when you read input A, do something which is, well, what is you thinking, and then come up with a result, and then someone's going to say, well, how did you do that? And you go, well, it's my job. Yeah, but we need you to write that down. It's not necessarily, people aren't necessarily that good at doing it, and so I think that's another sort of barrier. And I think if you're that way inclined, as a lot of the people that are picking up AI and saying, oh, look, it's really great because, look, I had this process and I wrote it down and then it did it for me. So, yeah, but other people go, yeah, I had this process, but some of it's opaque to me because it's going on in my head. And I'm actually not very good at, you know, looking at my own brain space and working out what it is I'm doing. I just know when I see this that I get that, you know. I don't think about it that much and I don't break it down. So I think that provides a barrier to some. I mean, it's a great opportunity for others, but I see that as an issue. You know, this whole idea of specking something out down to the nth degree just isn't everyone's bag.
Yeah, that feels sort of soluble to me, and it's a bit down to sort of setting the expectation with the model about who they're talking to and whether, you know, whether the environment that you're in at that point understands its role, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's perfectly capable of asking the right questions to get itself to an endpoint if yeah. it fully understands its role in that process and what that endpoint needs to be, right? Mm-hmm. And so the specced but unbuilt app I have sort of on my back burner is a system to get my artworks organized, because I have all my artwork, well, most of my artworks are physical, they're just paintings, and I've got photos of them and they're sort of arranged in folders, and but you know that I'll have consistent names and dates and metadata for them, and every time I want to share something or do a description, you want to put alt text on it, and I have to sort of do it from scratch. And so I've got alt text for various ones that are stored here and there. It's not an unusual problem, it's just a bit of a mess, right? I need to organize this so every painting, all the pictures of the same painting are in the same place. I've got metadata about it, I've got descriptions created by LLMs, and I can just go in, right, I need to share this one, I need to create a shop entry for that one, right? You know, I'm selling some prints of this one, so I need this photo, I need this description, I need that. It's all just there, right? So I was like, well, I've got to get from where I am now to there. It's a long conversation, me going, well, I don't quite know what I want, right? And saying, right, what I need from you, I don't want you to do shit all here other than get to the bottom of what I want, right? And then you sort of go through the process and you go, well, I don't want to talk about user experience. I just want to understand how I might do this. And then you sort of realize, well, you can't really divorce that from user experience. And then you start to think, well, actually the type of app this is does matter. Is it like a GUI app or a web-based app? Or is it actually, as we discussed at the end, the end point was, oh, this is really just an API, right? Yeah. Because if you've got an API endpoint, you can plug a web page onto it, you can plug a GUI onto it, or you can set up a bunch of agent skills and have the agent do it, right?
Yeah.
Which is immediately, and what the reason why I stopped on this was like, oh shit, this is just agent skills, isn't it? Right? Mm. And so I don't necessarily even need an API. Maybe the best way of doing this is to just, you know, is to enable an agent to be able to do it for me. And then what is the interface for that? You know, what are the agent skills? What am I asking it to do? Which is a totally different set of questions. Now, I don't know where I'm going with this. I sort of stopped when I was like, oh my God, that's a bit of a head fuck. Right, where am I going to take this? Because I wasn't thinking about it like that at all. So I was like, I'm going to have to go off and think about this for a bit. But yeah. I don't consider that a bad outcome, right? I don't know if that's the right solution. Let's be clear. I got to that point and thought, oh, that's interesting. Oh, I hadn't thought about it like that at all. I need to go and think about this. And it all sort of stopped there. I consider that a really big win, right? That model got me to where I needed to be. And I might go back to the start. We might just build a GUI. You know, I don't know. I don't know what we're going to do, whether I'll even get around to doing it. But the point is, it stopped me. Right, really, that stopped me, and the agent had done its job. Now, why had it done its job? Because that's like the job I told it. I was like, we're not getting anywhere near specs, we're not getting anywhere near code until I fully understand what I'm trying to do here. And I went into it with one expectation and came out of it with another, right? Yeah. And if we can get it to the point where for a novice user, it's sort of pre-prompted for that, if you've got a system that can wrap that and say, you want to do your email answering thing, right? The least worrisome thing about this is the mechanics of it doing that. You need to figure out how you're going to orchestrate this in a safe way that doesn't get you fired, right? you know what I mean?
Yeah,
right? Because me getting fired versus a lawyer or a journalist or a GP, right? There is one program that's going to say, don't respond like this, mate, right? You know what I mean? These are the guardrails. Don't do things like this. Do things like this. Completely different based on your profession, right?
One thing you said there, you said difference between, you know, AI skills, you know, which I know is something that you give to the AIs, and API. In my head, they're almost exactly the same thing, but do you think of them as something different?
AI skills is just a set of instructions you can give that tell the AI how to handle particular operations, right? So an example could be like NeoVim is both a GUI and an API, right? Plus it's got a bunch of stuff you can do on the command line, right? Mm-hmm. And the same goes, things like Obsidian has obviously a GUI, it has a command line, no doubt it's got APIs, it's also got back-end files, right? So as opposed to thinking I have to do something via the configuration interface in Obsidian, you would never do that. It's just a bloody YAML file, YAML or TOML or something, right?
Yeah.
So how are you telling an agent to do this, right? Well, it's obvious if you're doing it via the command line because it doesn't have access to the GUI. You have to go to the config file, at which point what can and should it do? Or should it do it through the command, the CLI, right? Mm-hmm. But it might also have an HTTP-based API that you could do things through. So especially when you're dealing with stuff like I almost always am by the command line, no, it isn't APIs unless you consider a CLI an API, right?
Yeah.
You know, and where there's a choice, do I have a preference between doing it through this interface or that interface, right? And so agent skills are as much about saying, you know, here's the way that I want you to handle this, because perhaps there's a difference between, you know, the two. A lot of CLIs have capability that the GUIs don't have and vice versa, for example, right? And an API might not be fully implemented, which is very, very often the case. I.e., you can only do this subset of stuff via the API. The rest of it has to be done through the CLI or via configuration files. So that's what skills are for me. They are literal English language. No, don't use that. Do use this, right? And sort of sidestepping it, going, all right, I'm going to look at the help files for this, you know, command, and then figure out what to do. No, don't do that. It's just command minus C, blah, 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 right?
Yeah.
But they're just instructions. I mean, I love the way they can badge up these things, agent skills, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I was going, oh, this must be really, really complex and sort of, you know, in depth, expect, you know, mountains of JSON or YAML configuration. Oh, just bloody... Yeah, mate, if you need to do this, do that. That's it, in English. And you're like, oh, okay. Well, that was easy.
Yeah, exactly. Because I've been doing some specing as well, and much more akin to how where you got to with your latest one, which is, you know, I'm a bit unsure what I want, you know, around some of these, this tennis rating thing that I built where you can use it's called an ELO rating, which is like a rating which a guy invented for chess and now gets used everywhere, but it's used in the ATP tennis tour, and I think that people now use it for basketball teams and baseball teams, and it just, you know, takes a win and a loss against two opponents and then updates the rating, and it can become quite useful. And so I was thinking about expanding it out. But similar to you, I had a sort of rough idea of what I wanted to do. And so I said, oh, okay, well, I think I want to build me this. So here are the six, I mean, it really was, you know, sort of 6 points. And then I said, oh, well, add to this if you can. And so it added 15 points. And I went, well, that's really fantastic. Get some predictions for every match, change those predictions. You know, it was all getting really, really hairy. And I'm like, okay, well, that's good, but you know, let's go MVP. So I said, yeah, take your suggestions, you know, put it into an MVP. And similar to you, I'm now sort of looking through it and taking some time to think about, well, what does that mean? And then I'm getting it to give me some detail. Well, how would you code that out? And I can see some places where it's going to be, you know, it's definitely a bit shaky. I'm thinking, well, I don't really want it to do that. And so and then, I, you know, it's now got me thinking about how I would, you know, tell it, make sure it avoids doing some of these things. What other markdown pointer files can I add in around code and reusing code and refactor as you go type elements can I add in to make sure it, you know, stays on the rails? So rather than, you know, more your Cato, which was build me a whole system, so I spec it all out up front. This is like, oh, build me one little bit of it, but actually, you know, work with the model to spec it out and actually take some time, you know, like you say, to rethink, you know, and discover, you know, I said this, it's come back with that. You know, how do I feel about that? You know, and something, you know, I find that I'm almost a sort of bottleneck in this because I don't just want to say, oh yeah, go and do all those fancy things, because I feel like I'm just going to end up with a mess and a product with too many bells and whistles and not actually doing what I want and then trying to work around that. So I'm being a bit of a fan of, okay, well, it's good to know that it's got all of those things that could come, but I actually want to think about, well, what do I really want? And so I'm now taking some time to mull that over before I go back with the next step, you know, which is very slow in AI terms because I'm taking several days to mull this thing over, you know. But like you said, well, yeah, it's a result for me.
It's not such difference in that sense from how things have been done up until now, which is essentially you sort of get going, right? You have a set of specs. You have to think quite hard about the things that you want, knowing full well that they're probably not perfect. And that you probably won't know perfect until it gets used. And so we get prototypes and early iterations and the alphas, alpha and beta test programs and stuff. And those are the bits that take the long time. You know what I mean? Because coders, when they've got a pretty free rein, can move pretty quickly. You can build up a lot of technical debt when those get into production. But, you know, ultimately, you know, we're not naive. A lot of products came about simply by people just doing it. And in that sort of scenario, it really is the humans that have been the slow part, right? They're just the people who have to make decisions and understand how things are going to be. And to then just test things and to figure out how to articulate what's wrong and why. And so I think maybe what you're seeing there is just, you know, everything's been fast forwarded, and because of your ability to have that conversation with the model, you are co-creating. Like you've learned a lot more quickly in the right context, because we all know if you want to pick up learn how to program Go manual from O'Reilly, right, you're going to see a bunch of examples in there that from like web development or something, right? But no, I don't want to build that type of thing in Go. I want to build a command line CLI. And so most of these examples aren't relevant to me. So it's very slow and clunky process trying to sort of mutate what you're learning about the language from a more generic perspective into the specifics that you need, right? They might not be covering the libraries that you want, right? So this process of conversing with the model and co-creating and asking questions and saying, well, you're suggesting I do this, why would you say that? Well, here's why, right? You're already in context. You started out the process doing something that you want or need to do, and so everything that you learn is getting slotted in the right place in the jigsaw puzzle. Now you might not get where you end to be, where you need to be. This is not a perfect process, but don't discount the amount of speed it's given you. So I don't think your implication was that you're more moving at normal speed, but the model's moving fast. I think that the whole process has been sped up. Have humans been sped up to the same degree as the computers? No, and that's kind of the point, isn't it? But you have been sped up, but you know your role in this is a lot faster than it would otherwise have been.
Yeah, I definitely. Yeah, well, and sometimes that's also why I need to take a breather, because in a way, not used to making so many decisions sort of so quickly, because you'd think, okay, well, you know, I need to code this up, takes me 3 days. While I'm coding it up, I'm also thinking about, you know, in the background and while I'm doing it, how things might pan out. And then you see a bit of data which you're, you know, just doing a small calculation on, and then you suddenly see something in the data which you think, oh God, that's going to affect how I do this thing over here. And so, you know, you get a little bit of scope creep in that respect, because as you work through one thing, you're rethinking how you're going to do the next thing, or perhaps even going back and changing something that you've already done. Whereas now,
well, there's a,
you get that in seconds, you know.
There's an effort debt there. And I think that, you know, effectively you're trying to second guess where you might be causing yourself hard work further down the line. And most developers learn quite early on to start testing things as early as possible. Because how much time, you know, I, when I started developing, I was always trying to just to develop the whole thing in one shot. You know, really bad idea. But I was always trying to do that because I was like, yeah, let's just do it. And you might think, well, you know, I'm a genius. I'll just code this out. It'll be perfect. But it isn't. And while doing that, you will have, you know, built up a whole bunch of problems for yourself that are going to be harder to engineer out. Than they would have been had you just broken it down into chunks. And of course, most modern programming languages, infrastructures, architectures want to be broken down into chunks. There's debates about how chunky things should be, but I don't think anyone really disagrees that you need to think about the architecture. And often that process is organic, right? You don't just think, oh, I need an app that's a calculator. Therefore, ping into my head, here's the full architecture of it. No, you're gonna feel your way through it, and you're gonna ask, well, why am I doing this? And what ends do I seek? And what, you know, how is it gonna be developed in the future? So that you don't do it in such a way that you're gonna shoot yourself in the foot. And I think that there's losses and gains in this process. The fact that you're being slowed down by just simply having your brain, you know, like worn out, you've got smoke coming out of your ears and shit. I consider that a happy side effect, right? Because if it's slowing you down, then I think that's probably a good thing.
Yeah. And it's interesting you talk about the test and learn effectively there, which is, you know, the ability to get something running, which then gives you data, which you can then loop around, learn from, and then make changes with. And I hadn't thought about it in exactly those terms, but I was thinking, I was chatting to a company, sort of retail company last week, and it got me thinking about, you know, the whole, how will AI change jobs in the real world, you know? And, you know, back to sort of, you know, how well would this specking idea, how well might that translate into, you know, non-coding jobs and more office-based, or maybe not office-based. But one of the things I thought about is, if you take the, if you posit that there are a number of agents that you have working for you now, and this could be desk-based, but I was thinking about it in terms of sort of, you know, in a retail sort of convenience store or sort of food and beverage, you know, coffee shop type scenario, where you've got people, you know, doing real physical things. And I was thinking, well, what opportunities are there here? And I didn't really come up with anything specific. But if we assume that there is, you know, a bunch of tasks that someone's doing, you know, a little bit more electronically enhanced, and that they can now get an agent that says, okay, you know, can you take this data from here, here, and here, which I've just collected via my scanner, and make a recommendation for me? Yeah, it could be around something like merchandising. Should I display these things over here or over there? Now, I know a lot of sort of the high-powered supply chain software is, you know, looking into this sort of thing. But you can imagine any sort of fairly low-level scenario, you know, the email one I mentioned earlier. And, okay, how is that, in quotes, you know, doing away with my job? Well, what I could perceive there is, well, now I've got something up and running that's doing a bit of my job. You know, it's probably going to be a very small part. And now I'm kind of sitting back and I'm watching it do it. And it's got its own sort of feedback loop. But also, I might need to rate how well it's doing. You know, and this is where we get into some of the stuff that I do on, you know, various platforms. So you're saying, well, okay, well, it's done the job. Well, I need to rate it along, you know, six different criteria. And I see that as a possibility of some of the new jobs, in inverted commas, that will be created. So you go from doing the job, and you've got experience with doing it, and you know what's supposed to happen. There's now an agent doing that particular task, and your job now is to give feedback to the system and that agent on what it's doing, so that can then be used to retrain it and improve it over time. You know, and this is, you know, more into sort of data science view of the world, but it does seem quite plausible to me that, you know, you've got people that do this job, you've now got agents doing bits of their jobs, but then you want some feedback on that. And then also the whole idea that you've now got to coordinate several of them, now they're coordinating and they're failing, well, need some feedback on that. So I wonder if there's, you know, part of what will open up here is going from doing the job to, you know, in a little bit like a manager, to judging others doing the job, but, you know, perhaps in a more granular way. So rather than doing a quarterly review for your employee, you know, you're reviewing your agents, you know, every 25 minutes or something.
There's such a gap between where we are now and that reality, both in terms of where the technology's at and where the skills are at. And a lot of what the corporate world, the business world does, is an echo of what's already happened in the technical arena. And I think we haven't figured these things out properly from a coding perspective yet. And it's moving really fast. But we're still a little way to go. Who knows, really? Given, you know, we don't really understand the impact of you know, all the code that's been developed by agents thus far. We don't know if there's a, you know, a delayed catastrophe coming. But even if we take the optimistic view, we're not there with coding, and therefore the idea that we're there for standard sort of business operations, I think, is naive. And will we get there? Probably, if all the companies don't collapse in the meantime. But the problem is that people are seeing capability, right? And thinking that that's the whole story, right? Yeah, of course, it can send emails now. It can create calendar entries. It can do anything that's got an API attached to it, right? Yeah. Whoopee-doo, let's do it. Woohoo! You know, cowboy. But, you know, that we have this concept of cowboy coders and stuff for a reason, because you do it in such a way because you don't care about the implications of getting things like security wrong, right?
Yeah.
What worries me is that I've heard some fairly innocuous side effects of productivity agents going rogue. And thinking you're like a few misplaced words away from, you know, a sexual harassment claim or something. You know what I mean? Because it sent an email and worded it weirdly. Because, you know, look, yeah. I mean, I've read that, or just sent an email that was blatant sexual harassment and attributed it to you. That would be really bad. But, like, I think people think about it, in fact, in terms of those dichotomies, right? But these are guessing machines, right? And it could be getting confused by some stuff that you've put in it, into it, or that you've got, you know, you work in the same organization as your girlfriend, you're sending emails to her that are a bit more playful, right? And that's fine. And then it's looking at your email history and go, well, this is how he interacts with people like this. Right? Or this is how he interacts with anyone, and sends a cheeky, knowing nod, nudge, nudge, wink, wink email to your boss, right? Who is a woman, right? And suddenly you're in a world of pain that isn't easily explained away by having an agent in the mix, right? Yeah. And so I worry that the guardrails need so much more thought than they're being given. And it disturbs me that there are people out there with little open claw servers running on their Mac Mini that don't have the required level. And again, it's not like we're not talking about a 1 in 1,000 mistake here. You know, oh, it only makes 1 mistake in 1,000, because if that 1,000 mistake results in you having to lose your job because of a sexual harassment claim, then who cares if it was 1 in 1,000,000, right?
Yeah.
That
yeah.
can't happen. Right.
Yeah.
But I've just described a scenario where if you don't put together the right guardrails, i.e. do not include emails to this person in my email log. Right.
Yeah.
Then it's completely plausible that it could do something earnestly that will lose you a job or worse. Right.
Yeah.
And so
yeah,
that's the thing that worries me. And it's why it's not getting, God forbid that it gets passed, corporate security and procurement, these mm-hmm. types of things. That's not a thing. Yet how many people are using OpenClaw already on the side of their desk in their corporate roles? You know what I mean? Yeah. That's problematic.
And also, I think that's another barrier for the uptake of these things in terms of corporations, because you're only really going to get benefit when you can do any of these things at scale. You know, there's no point in spending $100,000 developing a system which saves you 15 minutes a week for someone on minimum wage, and you're going to use it for one person because it's going to take you, you know, 25 years to get a return on your investment there.
Well, hold on. And so let's say that you can get your return on investment from a sort of wages perspective. Let's say all that's sewn up and then you get one lawsuit because of a rogue agent that costs you hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, right?
Yeah.
And that's the problem. You're not only is your return on investment scrubbed, so is your corporate reputation, right?
Yeah.
It's probably recoverable from, but, you know, screw your ROI. You know, I mean, if you've just got to be more careful than this.
Yeah.
And,
well, exactly. Yeah. And in order to get that ROI, you're going to then want to use it, you know, so it's running 24/7 and doing thousands of these tasks a day, which then, well, if you're doing thousands of tasks a day, and if your risk is 0.01%, then you're going to start coming across those incidents more and more often because you're doing it at scale. So I think that's another barrier, because it's fine to say, look, the agent looked at my diary and it looked like a meeting we had and it went to the internet and ordered me water, and then it turned up from a Deliveroo guy, and we all go, whoopie de doo, it's amazing what these agents can do. Imagine doing that for every single office of your company across the world and doing it wrong, and suddenly you've got, you know, 27,000 litres of water turning up at a cost of, you know, several hundred thousand pounds, and you're going, oh, that was a little mistake, you know. And like you say, so I think you get these demonstrations of people using an individual thing on their own, and it's great, and we can all see the promise of that, but then actually getting that to do it and repetitive thousands of times, repeating every day, hands off, is just another ball game.
Yeah, exactly this, and I think that is the point that's being missed in so much of the rhetoric around these things. Because so many of the arguments I hear are along the lines of, well, look, it can just do it, right? And I'm like, well, look, if all you're taking into account is capability, then I'm not going to disagree with you. These things are amazing, right?
Yeah.
I think, and the flip side is the haters as well. Well, you know, it's no bloody use. No one uses it. You know, the Ed Zitrons of this world, who I think, you know, he's got a lot of points in terms of the sort of business operations of these companies, but I think he's wrong. I mean, they are very useful. They justify the investment. I tend to agree with him. I tend to agree that there are real problems with the way that all this is being funded and the amount of investment they've got to claw back, which I don't think is possible. But
no.
I don't agree that these things are not useful. Right. And so we've got this dichotomy of arguments that basically says, you know, on one side, they're amazing, they'll do everything. On the other side, they're shit, it gets it wrong all the time. And going, well, no, I think you're missing the point. Right. Yes, it can do all of your our emails and your calendars and stuff, if you prompt it correctly and you've got the right system around it. And that's not hard. Getting from where we are now to a system that allows you to automate that type of stuff already exists. It's called OpenClaw, right?
Mm.
But that's not the gulf. The gulf isn't capability. The gulf is security, right? The gulf is privacy. The gulf is the damage that these things can do and the hackability of them, right? And that's not a big problem for you and me coding our little tennis projects and shit, right? Mm. It's a problem for big corporations who are rightfully risk averse. And I really think that is the problem. That's the problem that Palantir and OpenAI and all these other big players that are now focusing all their efforts onto corporations. I think the elephant in the room is security. And I think that a slow uptake of big contracts from corporations, governments, big public or private or organizations is simple risk management, which is not something that's been spoken about anything like it needs to be, right? So, and that's the gulf, right? That's what's going to bring this all crashing down, because that safety just isn't there.
Yeah.
And it needs to be by default.
Yeah, especially considering what's gone on in the last year in terms of cyber attacks and bringing companies to their knees. So, yeah, I'm all for that.
Yes, indeed.
Well, I feel like we've covered quite a lot of ground there, and we haven't even started talking about the journalist who created his own company, a guy called Evan Ratliff, who created his own company.
We'll come back to that, right?
Yeah, so, with AI assisted.
So I found that quite interesting. I want to do some more research.
Yeah.
I've even started trying to replicate some of the stuff that he was talking about just out of pure curiosity. And that's happening using Kato, right?
Yeah.
So,
it's a very similar trajectory. I mean, I've started to listen to the whole season because he did 8-12 episodes or whatever.
What's it called?
Shell Game.
Shell Game. So if you want to keep up, dear listeners, with what we are going to probably talk about, well, I say next, but we're legendary at not doing the thing we said we were going to do. But probably next, I'm going to go on this to, I'm doing some experiments in the same area, effectively a guy that sets up a whole properly trading company using almost only generative AI agents.
Yeah.
I've got a lot to say on it already, and I haven't even started properly listening or playing with these sort of approaches. So I think we definitely come back to this.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so that's good. Give something to look forward to. Right, well, that's good. Very good. Until next time.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, everybody. Cheers, Pete.
Cheers. See you soon. Bye.
The confusion matrix.